morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Barry Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the show, we are going to be talking to Fraser Goff about his new book about the Valles Caldera and its geology. Right now, I would like to welcome Bill Burke White. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. He is our regular foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you again.
And this may well be your last show for a while, because you are moving to Washington, D.C. to go to the State Department. Your mentor, Anne Marie Slaughter, who was formerly the dean at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, has been appointed Assistant Secretary of State by Hillary Clinton, and she will be Director of the Office of Policy Planning there. That's a huge change.
Well, Mary Charlotte, I can tell you that it is true that my mentor, Anne Marie Slaughter, is now the Assistant Secretary of State and Director of the Office of Policy Planning. While I cannot confirm or deny my next moves at this point, it is likely that by the end of the month I will no longer be able to be with you and will be based in Washington rather than Philadelphia. But your listeners will have to wait for an update before we can say anything formally about my exact next moves. It is true that Anne Marie Slaughter is now running the Office of Policy Planning, and it gives us a good chance to talk a little bit about what the State Department does.
Well, that's what I thought would be interesting, because we all kind of know that there's a State Department, but we really, I think many of us, really don't think about the fact that this is a rather large operation that has a lot of different offices within it. What is the overall mission of the State Department?
Well, the State Department was actually the first cabinet office created by George Washington back in 1789. And the Constitution vests all foreign affairs power with the president. And so when the country was just started, perhaps one could have thought that George Washington alone could run all of foreign policy. But it very quickly became apparent to him that he needed to delegate those tasks. And for that purpose, the State Department was created by Congress in 1789, and it is tasked with essentially all of the foreign affairs of the United States of America. And that actually includes a whole range of things that many of us never think about. Perhaps the way most of your listeners have interacted with the State Department is that the State Department issues American citizens' passports. Likewise, it issues foreign citizens' visas to come to the United States. But it also represents our interests in all of the 180 or more countries around the world, within more than 50 international organizations scattered around the globe. Then it also develops all of our foreign policy. It decides, or at least advises the president, who ultimately will decide, on the major foreign policy goals and strategies of the United States. So it's a very important department, and one that deals with lots of issues from American citizens and business interests abroad to really how we ought to deal with other countries and where our foreign policy ought to go.
Now, in the last 8 years, the State Department has been less important than the Defense Department, even in terms of what we normally think of as foreign policy decisions that would be made by a State Department. What happened? What was going on there during the Bush administration?
Well, during the Bush administration, the State Department was largely marginalized, and most foreign policy decisions were really getting made in the Pentagon. If you think about it, there's a number of different organizations or departments in Washington that have to do with foreign policy. There's the State Department, there's the Pentagon, which deals with military policy, there's the National Security Council, which are the president's advisors directly within the White House. And during the Bush administration, much foreign policy decision-making was actually being made at the Pentagon, and partly that was because President Bush had a rather militaristic foreign policy. Also, that was in part due to the fact that Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense for 6 years, was extraordinarily powerful. So anytime there was a battle between interests at the State Department and at the Pentagon, Rumsfeld would ultimately prevail, and the Pentagon's policy would come through. So while Colin Powell and Secretary Condoleezza Rice both traveled around the world a great deal and were seen as the face of American foreign policy, the decision-making process was being driven by the Pentagon, at times also by the Office of the Vice President, because Dick Cheney was obviously very close to Donald Rumsfeld, and also because he had a very powerful hand in the White House decision-making process. So during those 8 years, the State Department really played a much more marginal role. Perhaps the best example of that is before the war in Iraq, there was a considerable debate about whether the United States should, in fact, invade Iraq, and the State Department issued a report talking about the difficulties of actually controlling Iraq, the possible ethnic tensions and violence that would follow, and the fact that we really shouldn't go to war. That report never saw the light of day, and the Pentagon position that we could go to war with a very small force and very quickly transform the country prevailed. And so that's just very emblematic of the dangers that come when you marginalize the State Department or any department whose views really need to be heard in that kind of process.
How do you see, I mean, obviously we're just a couple of months into the Obama administration, but from the signs so far, the State Department looks like it's going to have a larger and sort of more traditional State Department-like role. Is that correct?
It certainly looks that way. Start by just looking at the personalities and who's been appointed where. The new Secretary of State is Hillary Clinton. Senator Clinton formerly was the First Lady. Thereafter, she was the senator from New York State. She's probably one of the two or three most powerful figures in the country. She's now running the State Department. Compare that to, say, Condoleezza Rice, who, while a distinguished professor at Stanford, certainly didn't have the kind of political capital that Secretary Clinton has. That makes it much more likely that Senator and now Secretary Clinton will be able to win policy battles with other departments, to bring decision-making processes back home to the State Department. The other thing you might look at is who's been appointed in other positions in the State Department. One of the things we have seen is some very high-level appointments of people like former Senator George Mitchell, Richard Holbrooke, who many thought might be a Secretary of State if Hillary Clinton had not taken the job. Those are people with a great deal of policy experience who are in very high-level positions, but once again, people who really can win turf battles, who can make sure the State Department's views are heard. At the same time, you see the Defense Department recognizing that it really is very good at some things, and the Defense Department ought to be commended for an extraordinary job yesterday rescuing an American ship's captain who had been captured by pirates. The Pentagon is very good at military operations. They are not a diplomatic body. They are not trained in diplomacy, and they have shown under Secretary Gates a much greater willingness to say that certain functions really are, or do belong with the State Department rather than in the Defense Department. And so I think you're seeing a willingness both of the State Department to take on more responsibility and of the Defense Department to recognize its strengths and its weaknesses.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White, our foreign correspondent. One thing about the State and Defense Departments is that they have, I mean, obviously the Defense Department has soldiers and all sorts of operations of that nature, but they also have a lot of overlapping departments where people kind of do the same or similar things in state and in defense. How does that work? How do they coordinate?
Well, our government is a government of redundancy, in a sense, and that's a very good thing because it means that a number of people in different places have overlapping responsibilities. Let me tell you a little bit about how the State Department's organized, and then we can look at the cross-ministry or cross-department coordination. The State Department consists of a variety of both regional and functional bureaus. When I say regional bureaus, for example, there there's a Bureau of European Affairs and a Bureau of South Asian Affairs and a Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. And within those bureaus, there are desk officers who are in charge of particular countries. And then there are also functional bureaus, and those are bureaus that deal with issues that aren't regional. In other words, there would be a bureau that deals with war crimes, or a bureau that deals with human rights, or migration, or economic affairs. Then within the Pentagon, there would similarly be a bureau that might deal with European affairs or NATO affairs, our treaty alliance across the Atlantic. And so if you had an issue, one issue that's come up recently is the United States position that we were trying to build a missile defense shield that would prevent missiles being launched by Iran from hitting the United States. And those missiles would have to have facilities in the Czech Republic, in Europe. And so an issue like that would fall within the State Department in the Bureau of European Affairs that would deal with the Czech Republic and with NATO. It would also fall within the Pentagon dealing with NATO and on a military basis. It would also fall within the domain of the National Security Advisor at the White House itself. And there are, on a daily basis, tens or hundreds of meetings on different issues in Washington at different levels of seniority, maybe at a deputy assistant secretary level, a sort of mid-level meeting, or an assistant secretary level, a higher level meeting, that would bring together people from the Pentagon, from the State Department, from the National Security Council, from Homeland Security, or from other offices that might be involved, to coordinate and make policy on whatever the issue is that's at hand.
And so there's actually interdepartmental coordinated meetings all the time. And one can imagine that sometimes these things are, you just use the word, turf battles. How do these things work? Is it really each department is trying to get its way? Do they really work well together?
Well, sometimes they work very well together, and sometimes they work terribly together. And our system really works quite wonderfully when there is good coordination. And really, the job of the National Security Council is to direct that coordination. And a good National Security Advisor will take the lead in ensuring that the State Department's view is heard and the Pentagon's view is heard, and that it all comes together in a coherent, viable policy. What we saw happen under the Bush administration, which was most unfortunate, was that the Pentagon always won at those interagency battles. And if the Pentagon always wins and doesn't listen to the views of other agencies within the government, that can lead to very problematic outcomes, like a poorly implemented strategy in Iraq. And so what you want to see is very good coordination and a great deal of discipline from the National Security Council. And President Obama chose General Jones, a very distinguished military officer, to run the National Security Council. And he has done an admirable job of taking a much more disciplined and focused effort at coordinating those interagency processes. And it's still too early, really, to tell how successful they will ultimately be. But good policy depends on good coordination among all of those branches of our government.
So Anne-Marie Slaughter, whom we had on this show some years ago, who was who's your mentor and who is now the Assistant Secretary of State, is the Director of Policy Planning at the State Department. What is that office? What do they do?
The Office of Foreign Policy Planning was actually founded by George Kennan at the beginning of the Cold War, and your listeners may recall that George Kennan authored the famous X telegram from Moscow when he said that the Soviet system needed to be contained but ultimately would collapse in on itself. And he is known as being one of the sort of foremost thinkers on American foreign policy, later in life a professor at Princeton. He founded this office office. And the Office of Foreign Policy Planning is really the Secretary's private think tank within the State Department. And its job, as you can read on the State Department website, is to first of all to deal with issues that cut across regions. So if the Secretary needs advice about one particular country, perhaps she could call the desk officer for that country. If she wants advice that cuts across a region, the Office of Foreign Policy Planning is supposed to do that. Likewise, secondly, it's supposed to deal with issues that have longer-term time horizons, things like global warming that might not fall within today's immediate problem but has a longer time horizon. And finally, to be a voice of dissent, to critically look at every policy that's being proposed and ask whether it's really the right policy strategy, whether there might be a better strategy available, and to give a kind of devil's advocate approach to any action being taken to make sure it really is the right strategy and the best strategy to proceed with.
My guess would be that that devil's advocate position was not played out very strongly in the last 8 years.
I think that's a fair guess. Like you, I was not in government then, nor am I at the moment, and so I don't know exactly what did happen. But what it does seem to have happened was two things. First of all, the State Department itself was marginalized. So even if the Office of Foreign Policy Planning was playing a strong role in critiquing ideas and making sure the best ideas were going forward, those ideas were getting lost at the interagency level when it was time for Secretary of State Rice or Powell and Secretary Rumsfeld to sit down. The critical ideas coming from the State Department, if they were there, weren't getting heard. Only time will tell, and perhaps books will be written that help us understand that process more intricately in the future. But clearly those ideas were getting lost, and one of the most promising elements that we're seeing in the new Obama structure of government is I think much better balance among agencies and an ability to try to bring in more voices into the policymaking process.
So is there a corresponding department in the Department of Defense, or corresponding office in the Department of Defense to the Office of Foreign Policy Planning that Anne-Marie heads?
Yes, in fact, there is, and it's actually called the Office of Policy Planning, and it's being led by a woman named Michelle Florney, who has been recently confirmed by the Senate, and she is an expert from a Washington think tank on military policy planning. The difference between those two offices really is that the Department of Defense is supposed to be doing defense planning. In other words, asking questions about what kind of wars will we fight, or what kind of wars do we need to be prepared to fight? What kind of skills or resources do our troops need to have a capacity for? If, say, in 1990, we had thought hard about the fact that any future wars might involve serious street-to-street fighting like we saw in Baghdad, we might have planned a very different kind of military strategy, one that prioritize training troops to deal with civilians, to work in in inner city confines rather than fight big wars across the plains of Poland with the Soviet Union, which is what we had prepared for before that. And so the Office of Policy Planning and Defense is supposed to be asking what kind of wars do we need to fight down the line and how might we do that well? How might we better use our military to win friends in Afghanistan rather than to make enemies there? In the State Department, the Office of Policy Planning will be thinking about particular policies of diplomacy. Where might we want to commit more diplomatic strength? How might we better capitalize on where we do have a strong alliance relationship? And so there are different kinds of policies, but both offices are really supposed to be the brain trust, the think tank, the internal advisors within those respective departments.
We're talking to our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White. I think it's notable that the directors of the offices of policy planning in both state and defense are women right now. I think that's probably a historic first.
I can tell you it's a historic first because I know for certain that Anne-Marie Slaughter is the first woman to be appointed head of policy planning in the State Department. And I think this is a very important shift. One of Secretary Clinton's stated goals is to deal with and promote women's rights more heavily than we have done before. There are a number of appointments that have been rumored, and one can read on the web those rumors. I won't speculate because they're rumors at this point of other senior women who will be appointed as well and so forth. But I think it's important both as to very symbolically indicate that women really now are at a very high level in policymaking in both defense and the State Department. It's also going to be very interesting to see whether placing women in those positions will lead to different kinds of outcomes. The women who have been appointed, both Anne-Marie Slaughter and Michelle Flourney, who we're speaking about, or Secretary Clinton, have a great deal of experience in all of the important qualifications for the job. It'll be interesting to see whether they look at their roles differently, whether they have slightly different priorities, and whether those might make us both more secure and also help us promote women's roles in other countries. Take, for example, Afghanistan. Afghanistan's a country where I believe that if women had a larger role in the governance process, you'd have a more secure country. And it may be that putting women in these positions in the United States will play an important role in our embracing a larger role for women in those countries as well.
Your word in God's ear, as they say, Bill Bergwhite. So let's talk about some of the foreign policy challenges that are coming up. There are obviously many, some of them caused by the policies of the previous 8 years, and some of them caused by things like global warming and other environmental situations.
It is a very scary moment in the world. If you look around the globe, I am hard-pressed to find a country or a region where there are not extraordinary foreign policy challenges for the United States. We can just dance around the world for a moment. If you look right now off the coast of Somalia, we have pirates, perhaps the least of our serious concerns, but ones that are problematic to world shipping. You don't have to go very far to be in Afghanistan, where it's very unclear whether the current government will be able to continue governing and whether we can move toward a more stable country there. Just across the border in Pakistan, you have what I think might be today's largest threat, which is the possibility of instability or a militant Islamic regime with a nuclear weapon in Pakistan, one where we have very little ability to control. Move over to China. China is a country that's facing an economic crisis more severe than ours, but also one that doesn't have the social security structures that we have to help people in those circumstances, and the possibility for some kind of economic collapse in China or even instability in China is very real. Russia, a country that earlier this year engaged in a war in Georgia, where it's unclear to what degree that kind of policy that we saw in Georgia will continue. If you go to Latin America, Mexico is a country, again, with financial concerns and ones that may spill over to the United States again. So it's, Africa, again, long-time instability and the piracy issue is perhaps the way that's most visualized at the moment, but it's hard to find a country in Africa that isn't problematic. Sudan, the president has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. It's unclear where that will go. We talked in an earlier show about the situation in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine. Very, very concerning and unclear where America will go there. So it is a time of, and I forgot to mention the obvious, Iraq, which is moving towards stability, but unclear whether that stability will take hold. So if you look around the world, I cannot think of a time since the Second World War that the world has looked as scary as it has. There have been, I didn't even mention North Korea, that last week launched a missile across the Sea of Japan. So it's a very scary moment. The one good thing I would say is that we have a very competent set of people working on these issues at the moment. Secretary Clinton has recently become the Secretary of State, but she has hired some very experienced diplomatic hands. Richard Holbrooke, who has helped end the war in the Balkans, is now dealing with the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan. George Mitchell has been appointed to deal with the situation in the Middle East. Again, a former senator who brought peace to Northern Ireland. Dennis Ross is working on the area involving Iran, and that was another country I didn't mention in our list of scares. But he is very experienced in working in the Middle East and has a great deal of knowledge. So we have created a very senior level set of diplomats who are out there worrying about these things, listening, traveling, doing the things we failed to do in the last 8 years, and it's unclear whether we'll be able to solve any of these problems, but we are at least now seriously engaged in the process.
One of the criticisms of the Bush administration was that they continually talked about terrorism, but really didn't seem to address the roots of terrorism. In other words, what are the conditions in countries, poor countries, whatever, that give rise to terrorism? Do you see the Clinton administration, Hillary Clinton administration in the State Department looking at these things differently?
Yes, and it's very hard to change the way an entire government operates or thinks. But one thing you will have not heard is the mention of the war on terror. That disappeared with the Bush administration. And I think you saw, for example, statement by President Obama reaching out to the Islamic Republic of Iran last year. You saw a statement by Obama with respect to dealing with terrorists that go beyond the kind of Bush administration rhetoric. And that is extraordinarily important and a very good first step. Obviously, we need to figure out how we deal with root causes. How do you create a Pakistan or a Saudi Arabia that doesn't create a next generation of potential terrorists? How do you deal with longer-term problems of economic development, of prosperity, of inclusivity? And those are problems that we don't have easy solutions to. So the first steps that have been taken, I think, are very, very promising, signaling that we're going to close Guantanamo, saying that we're not going to torture people. But moving beyond that to dealing with root causes is going to take a lot of deep thinking by the very people we were talking about earlier in the show.
Do you feel that do you see that the Clinton regime in the State Department is looking at economic and environmental issues as part of foreign policy questions?
It's in a way too early to know for sure, but there are some positive signs. First of all, there is an economics bureau in the State Department, and it is, I think, having a larger role. I don't know this for sure, but from everything we see, a larger role in policymaking processes. And if anything, the economic crisis has reminded us all that economics and foreign policy are deeply intertwined. Issues of the environment, President Obama has clearly signaled that dealing with climate change is going to be a high priority. There have been appointments of people to positions related to climate change. The key position in the State Department that will deal with climate change is a position called the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. That position was created by the Bill Clinton administration, and the first person to hold it was former Senator Tim Worth. That position has yet to be filled, and so it'll be interesting to see who fills it. There's been speculation on the web that it might be someone whose priority is women's affairs. It might be someone whose priority is really environmental affairs, but we're still waiting to see who is going to have that position and what direction will be taken there. But the people who have been appointed thus far, people who have clearly written about in their scholarly works or dealt with in a policy capacity before, the interconnectedness of issues ranging from environment to migration to conflict to economics to climate change. So we need to sort of stand by and keep watching, but the initial signs are positive. The indications that the United States will take a lead on the next round of whatever comes after Kyoto in dealing with climate change. So I'm optimistic, but we still need to wait and see.
You've talked about the stronger role for the State Department now when the power was really concentrated in the hands of the Defense Department over the last 8 years. How does the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, feel about this? Do you see any signs?
Yeah, there have been very strong indications that the Defense Department is very willing to hand back some of those responsibilities that had been taken over or pushed off to the Defense Department. The Defense Department was essentially running Iraq since Paul Bremer left. That was not a role they really wanted. So one of the things you're seeing is even statements by General McMullen, who's the general who is in charge of that part of the world, made a statement publicly about saying, how about we hand over some of our budget back to the State Department, saying that some of the things that the Defense Department was supposed to be doing really were diplomacy, and that that money ought to be at the State Department. That's something you never hear in Washington. You don't hear people giving away their budgets. So there are certainly signs of a sense of what is the Defense Department good at? What is the State Department good at? Well, the Defense Department is good at the deployment of military force. The State Department needs to be good at the deployment of diplomatic power and pressure and persuasion. One of the problems, of course, is that there are 25 times as many people who work at the Defense Department as the State Department. And one of the bigger, longer-term questions is whether we're going to grow our diplomatic corps so that we have more Foreign Service officers putting a diplomatic face out for the United States, and perhaps in the process somewhat fewer soldiers. The two need not be a direct trade-off, but asking where we need to put those resources. And certainly I think it would make sense for us to have more than 25 times as many people at defense than at state.
Well, in theory, good diplomacy leads to less war, and in practice as well.
If you can do that, right, in an ideal situation, obviously you would never get rid of the military or the Defense Department as a very important role, but you wouldn't need to deploy it. It would be a theoretical force there if we need it, but you wouldn't need it because you'd be doing such a good job at diplomacy. And had we done a better job of diplomacy in the lead-up to the Iraq War, we might well have been able to avoid that war, achieve our own objectives, and thereby not use the military capacity and the vast expenditures of money attached thereto.
I mean, this leads to a much longer conversation than we have time for today, but part of what makes for peace is justice and relative economic equality and fairness, and that's something that we don't have anything remotely resembling that on the planet right now.
Absolutely, and many of the causes of conflict are economic, and if you look at whether it's pirates in Somalia or a war over oil in the Sudan, north and south, that conflict is economics-driven and driven by a difference in prosperity between north and south. The conflict in Iraq is in part an economic conflict. Everywhere around the globe you see conflict. One of two things is usually at the root of it, economics or religion. Occasionally it's ideology, but more often than not it's economics or religion. And if you can come up with an economic strategy that makes everyone feel like they have some reason to be vested in not going to war, you're going to have a lot less conflict, a lot less need for conflict. And one of the things I hope that both the Office of Policy Planning at the State Department and the Department more generally do is to think about those underlying causes and how we can reduce the threats that lead to those conflicts.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. So we've got just a little time left. You were recently in Europe, and you were there at the time that President Obama was traveling in Europe. What kind of responses did you see firsthand on the part of the Europeans to our president?
This was quite extraordinary. I was in Paris last week, unrelated to President Obama's visit, and it was, to say the least, Obama mania. My favorite story from this is the cover of Paris Match, which is a sort of weekly French publication, has a giant picture of Obama that simply says, "Obama, the European, in 48 hours, undoes 8 years." That says it all. Obama is loved in Europe. respected. But importantly, it is more than just aren't we glad now to have a president as an American who the Europeans like? He has very strategically used this power. The European people love Obama, which means that the European leaders want to be close to Obama. And Obama can use his popularity in Europe to get the Europeans to do things we want them to do, whether it's to support us in Afghanistan, whether it's to put pressure on the Iranians. He has an immense political capital abroad, and he's using that very wisely. And so Obama, the European, is good for America.
Bill Burke White is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and if my sources are correct, will be at the State Department and will no longer be able to be our foreign correspondent. I'm very sad about this, but I'm very happy for you. This is, I guess, our last show for a while.
Well, I certainly hope to be on the air with you again, and if it takes a couple of years before I am, your readers will know to find me somewhere else in a different job for a while, but I have no further comment other than that I will miss you guys.
Well, we will miss you too. Bill Burke White, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Take care.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Fraser Goff about his new book about the Valles Caldera. Stay tuned to KSFR.